Well, good evening. It is very good to see all of you here this evening. We're continuing our Bible study on the Old Testament. We finished up the book of Judges last time, and this evening we're getting into the beginning of the books of Samuel and Chronicles. Let's initially look at a little bit of background as to why we are covering Samuel and Chronicles, Samuel, Kings, and Chronicles in the way that we are. The books of 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, really make a four-volume set. They are consecutive. They are part of the same story, probably compiled by various authors. Samuel, undoubtedly, being the one who wrote the opening portions, much of say the book of 1 Samuel, anyway. Other prophets, perhaps Nathan the prophet, perhaps certainly Isaiah and Jeremiah. Jeremiah is probably the one who put those books in the final form. The book of 2 Kings comes up through about the midway of Jeremiah's ministry. In fact, in the King James Bible and in some other translations, but the King James preserves it. If you look in there and open up First Samuel, it says the first book of Samuel, otherwise called the first book of the Kings. And you start going through there, and you find Second Samuel is otherwise called the second book of the Kings, and First Kings is otherwise called the third book of the Kings. There are four volume set of the whole of the same thing, and they tell the story beginning with the time of Samuel, the story of Samuel's birth, and follow on through to the captivity of Judah. Now, 1 and 2 Chronicles are a separate volume. They were written later. They were written after the return from the exile, undoubtedly by Ezra. They tell the story that overlaps Samuel and Kings, but from a different perspective. What you find as you go through 1 Chronicles is that the first nine chapters of Chronicles are primarily genealogy that come down and sort of set the stage, begin with Adam and come all the way down. We find the genealogies of some of the tribes, of the Levites. We find the genealogy of David himself. Most of the rest of 1 Chronicles focuses in on the reign of King David. There is very, very little, just a matter of a few verses that deal with Saul. But most of 1 Chronicles deals with the reign of King David. The beginning of 2 Chronicles deals with the reign of Solomon. And we find that really the book of 2 Chronicles focuses in on a few kings of Judah. Focuses in primarily on Solomon, to a lesser extent on King Asa. Focuses in on Jehoshaphat somewhat, more so on Hezekiah is a major focus, on King Josiah. And really those are, everything else sort of links the story together, but we find that Chronicles tells the story with just incidental mention of what was going on in Israel. When you read the books of 1 and 2 Kings, you find a pretty balanced account of what was happening in Judah and what was happening in Israel on down until Israel went into captivity. And then the focus, of course, is on Judah. Chronicles tells the story differently. It is primarily a focus on events centered in Jerusalem and centered with the events of the house of David. There is a reason, and that is that Chronicles was written after the exile, and it was written for the purpose of helping to focus attention of the people on where God was working. Because after the exile, when the Jews came back from Babylon, the Samaritans were in northern Israel in the area that had been the northern city, the northern tribes. And they were claiming an affinity, claiming a connection, which was really not proper. And Chronicles was written to emphasize some of that and to make it plain where God was working. So what we're doing is that the accounts in while the accounts 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st, 2nd Kings is a continuous story, Chronicles parallels, has material that parallels through. And so in order to get the complete picture, we're going to parallel sort of a harmony here. We've mentioned that Chronicles gives a brief summary of events. First Chronicles starts with Adam, with genealogy, and it traces on down to the end of Second Chronicles with the return of the Jews from Babylon under Zerubbabel. It focuses down to the beginning of the return from the exile. It is a key book in the opening chapters for the genealogies, which sometimes we think of as tedious, but you know, without that framework, you couldn't go back and connect up some of these priestly families and some of these various ones, and it enables us to sometimes make sense of who certain individuals were and what their connection was. Their prophecies, for instance, about the family of Eli. If you remember, because of Eli's sin in terms of his sons, the prophecy was made that Eli's family was going to cease, the high priesthood was going to cease through them. And as you put the story together from Chronicles and it gives you the genealogy, we find that it was that event did occur. It occurred during the reign of King Saul when virtually all of the descendants of Eli's family were slaughtered except for one man. And the high priesthood passed into a collateral line. All of the high priests descended down from Aaron, but, you know, normally it was father-son, just in the same way a kingship descends. And when a whole branch of the family was wiped out, then it was another line of Aaron's descendants. And we'll comment on that as we come to it. First, as we notice here, let's just begin a little bit in First Chronicles and notice what we have, and then we'll come back to the main emphasis of the story. First Chronicles, of course, begins with the genealogy beginning with Adam, and comes down and traces through the various families of Abraham, including Ishmael and Esau. And chapter 2 goes into the children of Israel and begins to give a more detailed account of the genealogy of Judah, which is given here in chapter 2. Gets into details on that. And as you come on down through the genealogy of Judah here in chapter 2 and chapter 3, chapter 4, we find chapter 3 deals with the sons of David and gets into details of David's family. And then you get into more details of the genealogy here in chapter 4, dealing again with the descendants of Judah. So there's a lot of detail provided for Judah. Chapter 5 gets into more genealogy of Reuben. Chapter 6 goes into the Levites. And there is background information here in terms of the Levites. Continuing on, chapter 7 continues with the genealogies of Benjamin and Naphtali, Manasseh, Ephraim, Asher. Then chapter 8, which continues on in the genealogy of Benjamin, gets down to brings the story down to King Saul, and that comes on down here in chapter 9, continues that part of the story down through the story here of King Saul in chapter 10. Ends up the story of Saul, and then beginning in chapter 11, we start with the kingship of David. So the opening portions of Chronicles is primarily genealogical information. Now, let's go back to 1 Samuel and let's look at a little bit of an overview of the story. The portion that we're going to cover this evening brings us down primarily through the life of the prophet Samuel. Now, I think we went into last time the fact that Samuel and Samson were contemporaries. They were both born at the end, right near the end of the period of the Judges, and they were evidently born very likely within the same year. We're not told exactly the age of Samuel, but as you put the story together, he couldn't have been much younger than Samson. We will, for our purposes, a year or two is sort of insignificant because the story flow is what we're looking at. As you remember from last time, the death of Gideon, the nation of Israel sort of split in three directions in terms of judgeships, and we find that within a short time after then, after the death of Gideon, within a relatively short time, certain things happened. The Ammonites came to power in the east, the Philistines in the southwest. And then there were problems with this illegitimate son of Gideon's that tried to take over the kingship sort of in the center of the country. The Philistines, these were all contemporaneous events. We saw that last time in our study of the book of Judges. And the Philistines began a period of 40 years of dominance. Now, Samuel and Samson were both born pretty well at the beginning of this period of Philistine dominance, and grew to maturity during these 20 years. It was halfway through this 40 years of Philistine dominance when the Philistines captured the ark, and Eli's sons, Phinehas and Hophni, were slain. And that began the period of the, let's say, the last 20 years of Philistine dominance. The book of Judges tells the story of Samson's 20 years of judgeship, which coincided with the last 20 years of Philistine dominance. Samuel, on the other hand, had grown to maturity, had reached maturity about the age that the ark was captured, and over the course of the next 20 years functioned as a judge there. And at the end of that time, right around the time of Samson's death, Samuel brought the nation to a point of revival and stirred them up to obey God. It's interesting that as you go through the story over and over, we see the nation crying out to God for their problems. We find that they had sort of a superstitious regard for God. It was as though that there was a good luck charm or something that could be used to sort of ensure God's favor, when what God is really after is a yielded, surrendered heart and mind. Now, the ark was in the tabernacle was in Shiloh for a period of a little over 300 years. from the time early on, you know, when Joshua crossed the Jordan River, initially the ark and the tabernacle was set up there at Shechem just across the river. And then right toward the end of Joshua's lifetime, it was moved to Shiloh. And it was through the whole period of the Judges, the ark and the tabernacle abode in Shiloh. And, you know, it's interesting. People have a way of getting comfortable with things and thinking that whatever they see represents the eternal order of things. And as we're going to see, there's an important lesson. Now, the book of Samuel opens with Samuel's parents coming up to Shiloh. And they were a Levitical family. Samuel's genealogy is given in Chronicles also. They were a Levitical family. Samuel's father lived was from the area of Mount Ephraim. He was a Levite who lived in that area, called an Ephrathite, which was Ephrata was an old name for Bethlehem, and that term is sometimes used. He had two wives, and one of his wives, Hannah, had been unable to have children. And they went up to sacrifice to the Lord in Shiloh, and we find that the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were priests. And so they came up here, and Hannah was very disturbed. She was unable to have children, really desired children. In verse 11, she vowed a vow. And she told God, she said, "If you will indeed look on the affliction of your handmaid and remember me, and not forget your handmaid, but will give unto your handmaid a man child, then I will give unto the Lord all the days of his life, and there will no razor come upon his head." So Samuel was destined to be a Levite from his mother's womb. Samson was also a Levite from his mother's womb, if you remember the story, part of the parallel between the two. And in addition, John the Baptist, you know, was a Levite from his mother's womb. So there are times when God set someone apart for a special calling early on. Well, Hannah made this vow, and Eli came in on her while she was praying, and he initially thought that she had been drinking. But after talking with her briefly, it became apparent that, no, she was very emotional and distraught, but she was not, she'd not been drinking. She was not taking lightly or casually God's way. So Eli told her, verse 17, "Go in peace. The God of Israel grant you your petition that you have asked of him." And so... anyway, she went her peace, and we find that in the aftermath of that, she conceived and bore a child. And the name of the child was Samuel, which meant "Ask of God." Now, Hannah did not go back to the tabernacle with her family for several years. At the time when she weaned Samuel, she brought him up to leave him there. We're not told exactly how old he was. It's not uncommon in the Middle East, among the Arabs to this day, to postpone weaning until even the age of 6 or occasionally, 6 or 7. That's about the outside limit. But that was not uncommon in the Middle East. It was, form of birth control and other things. I would suspect, given the circumstances here, that Hannah probably was on the outside limit rather than the inside limit, because she knew when she weaned him she was going to have to bring him up to the tabernacle. So I suspect that knowing mothers, that you know, she was on the one hand prepared to do it, but not any earlier than she had to. So she brought him up and presented him there to Eli. Chapter 2 opens with Hannah's prayer, her rejoicing before God. We're told that the child was here, verse 11 of chapter 2. And the child ministered unto the Lord before Eli the priest. And so as a little boy, he was there to serve in the tabernacle. Now, Eli had two sons. Eli had two sons, but we're told in verse 12 they were sons of Belial. They knew not the Lord. They knew not the Eternal. The reference is not that they didn't know about God. Certainly they had grown up there around the tabernacle. They knew many things about God. They had heard things from their father. They had learned how to carry out certain ritual functions. They had knowledge. They had information. But they didn't really know God. They were not acquainted with God. They had no personal relationship with God. In fact, in verse 12, they're called sons of Belial, sons of the devil. They were individuals who really had no personal relationship with God. God wasn't real to them. They didn't live their life in awe of God. Not at all. In fact, the very opposite. We find that their attitude toward the sacrifices was they wanted what they wanted. Now, the priests were entitled to a certain portion of the sacrifice. But there was a procedure. And nobody was to take anything until the fat was burned on the altar to God. But that was not the way they wanted it. They came in, grabbed their part. And somebody tried to, call it to their attention. Verse 16, if any man said unto them, let them not fail to burn the fat presently, and then take as much as your soul desires. Phinehas and Hophni would say, no, give it to me now, and if not, I'll take it by force. Now, what do you think the attitude of people coming up to the tabernacle to worship? What kind we're told in verse 17, the sin of the young men was very great before the Lord. Men abhorred the offering of the Lord. They brought an attitude of disrespect for God's servants because they conducted themselves in a corrupt way. Now, what was the solution to that, by the way? Did you just go off and build your own? Did you go off to, you know, worship Dagon? Some of you remember the 70s. This was a particular portion of Scripture that was very helpful to me in the 1970s, given the conduct of certain individuals who were in high positions, who were the equivalent of the spiritual equivalent of Phinehas and Hophni. And, you know, the answer here, what do? You do what Samuel did. See, Samuel pleased God. And he ministered before the Eternal, being a child, verse 18, girded with a linen ephod. His mother made him a little coat, you know, just like the one that the priests wore. She brought it up year to year. And God blessed Hannah, we're told, and she had more children. She had three sons and two daughters. And Samuel grew before the Lord. Verse 22, Eli was very old, and he heard all that his sons did unto Israel, and how they lay with the women that assembled at the door of the tabernacle, the congregation. You know, here they were, grabbing what they could grab of the offerings that were brought up there, trying to seduce the women that came up there with their families. I mean, you're talking about a couple of corrupt individuals. Eli heard about some of this, and he would just sort of fuss at him a little bit. Verse 23, he said, now why do you do such things? I hear of your evil dealings by all this people. No, my sons, it's not good. It's no good report that I hear. You make the Lord's people to transgress. Well, you guys are sure setting a bad example, and you better stop that. Well, they didn't hearken to the voice of their father. They ignored him. And he didn't do anything about it. Samuel grew on, was in favor both with the Lord and with men. So, you know, as Samuel began to grow on up here to be a young boy, year by year went by, Samuel's conduct was such a marked contrast to Phinehas and Hophni. You know, people noticed. A man of God, a prophet, came to Eli, he's not named here, and admonished Eli as to how his family, his ancestors, had been chosen way back in Egypt, the family of Aaron. Eli was, of course, a descendant of Aaron. And how that they had been given a very high position. And verse 29, here's what he told him, "Wherefore kick you at my sacrifice and my offering, which I have commanded in my habitation, and honor your sons above me, to make yourselves fat with the chiefest of all the offerings of Israel, my people." So, he says, you know, you're showing disrespect. And he told Eli, you are honoring your sons above me. You're placing them before me because you should not allow it. They should not be allowed to do what they're doing. And the fact that Eli had not removed them from the priesthood, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. And that was a very serious matter. And he was warned on more than one occasion. He was warned here by a prophet. Later he was warned in a dream that Samuel was given. As well as the fact that he himself should have known better. So God told him that he would cut his house off. And his family would be cut off from before the altar. And Phinehas and Hophni would both die. And God said in verse 35, "I'll raise me up a faithful priest that'll do according to all that is in my heart and in my mind. And I'll build him a sure house. He'll walk before my anointed forever." Well, as we come on down chapter 3, that happened, by the way, in the days of King David, when the priesthood was changed. We'll go through that a little later. It was switched from one branch of Aaron's family to another. Chapter 3 tells the story as the child Samuel ministered unto the Lord before Eli. The word of the Lord was precious in those days. In other words, God was not regularly communicating through the high priest because of Eli's transgression. Eli had been warned and he hadn't done anything. He was a very elderly man by this time. His eyesight was bad, and Samuel evidently slept in a little adjoining room to Eli. And they lay down to go to bed that night, and the Lord called Samuel in verse 4. And Samuel, of course, thought it was Eli calling him, heard a voice calling his name. So he got up, ran into Eli, and Eli said, "I didn't call you. Go back and go to sleep." So it happened again. Samuel ran back in there and he said, "No, I didn't call you." Verse 7, "Now Samuel did not yet know the Lord, neither was the word of the Lord yet revealed unto him." You know, we're told earlier that Eli's sons didn't know the Lord, but there's quite a contrast. They had no interest in coming to know God. Samuel, on the other hand, was a little child, a little boy. Chapter 3, I would say, let's say, somewhere around 12 years of age, something of that sort. He was, to a point where God began to reveal himself to Samuel. And he was still a child. And so again God called him, and he came back to Eli, and Eli said, "No, it's not me." But now Eli began to dawn on him what was happening. And he told Samuel, verse 9, "Go back and lie down, and if you hear this again, then say, 'Speak, Lord, your servant hears.'" Well, Samuel went, laid back down. Sure enough, God called him again. And Samuel answered. And God said, I'm going to do a thing in Israel which both the ears of everyone that hears it shall tingle. And I'm going to bring all these things against Eli that I have spoken. And I'm going to judge his house for the iniquity that he's done. Verse 13. Because his sons have made themselves vile, and he restrained them not. Therefore I have sworn unto the house of Eli that the iniquity of Eli shall not be purged with sacrifice or offering forever. And Samuel lay in there till the morning, got up, opened things up. And Eli called him and brought him in there and told him, said, I want you to tell me what God said. And you better tell me everything that he said, because you're going to be in serious trouble if you don't. So Samuel told him everything. And Eli just sort of accepted it. He said, well, it's the Lord. Let him do what seems good. Samuel grew. The Lord was with him. And we're told all Israel from Dan to Beersheba knew that Samuel was established to be a prophet of the Lord. You know, it came on through his adolescent years as he was maturing. And people just knew Samuel was different. And they could see it. They could see his attitude. They could see his sincerity. They could see the seriousness with which he went about the functions there at the tabernacle. The Lord appeared again in Shiloh. The Lord revealed himself to Samuel. Revealed himself to Samuel by the word of the Lord. So God would give certain visions and revelations to Samuel. Israel went against the Philistines to battle, and they pitched beside Ebenezer. The Philistines pitched in Aphek. And Israel was smitten before the Philistines. Several thousand people, about 4,000 died. And the people got together in verse 3 and they said, what's the problem? Why has God allowed the Philistines to smite us? Now notice their thinking, verse 3. Let's go fetch the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord out of Shiloh. When it comes among us, it may save us out of the hand of our enemies. You see, it was a matter of treating the Ark as though it were sort of a good luck charm. Well, if we bring the Ark out here, you know, the Ark will protect us. People have this allure of idolatry. It's as though something physical, something you can see and touch and feel, that somehow is real. That'll protect. Well, the real protector was Almighty God. And the reason Israel was not being blessed was because of their own disobedience to God. But you see, instead of the people repenting and changing their attitudes, changing their conduct, they said, well, we'll bring the Ark down here. That'll take care of us. They sent to Shiloh to have the Ark brought. And Phinehas and Hophni brought it down there. Phinehas and Hophni, these are the two guys who were fornicating in the shadow of the tabernacle. These are the two guys who were grabbing the offering and treating the sacrifices of God with contempt. These are the two guys that didn't know the Lord. But all of a sudden, these are really religious men. These are the priests. They're going to bring the Ark down there. As though somehow, you know, God is going to honor the presence of these two corrupt individuals. Well, the Philistines got all shook up when they heard that the Ark was there. They said, verse 7, the Philistines were afraid. They said, God has come into the camp. You know, this is the hand, this is the mighty God that smote the Egyptians. So they began to get scared and nervous. But you see, they had a superstitious approach as well. It's like, well, they brought their God in. You somehow can put God in the box. Well, they decided, well, look, we're going to go down fighting. So the Philistines fought, and Israel was smitten, verse 10. They fled every man to his tent, and there was a great slaughter. About 30,000 Israelites fell. The Ark of God was taken. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were slain. And a man, a Benjamite, came running back to Shiloh and got there. Eli was sitting on a seat, an elevated seat, and he was very nervous, very upset, been worried, sick ever since they had taken the ark away. You know, he hadn't wanted them to do it, but Eli had not dealt with them when he was in a position to deal with them, and they didn't pay him any attention. They just ignored him. What was he going to do? So Eli asked what was going on. He was 98, we're told at the time, verse 15. And they told him that the ark had been captured and Phinehas and Hophni were dead. And when they told him that the ark was captured, he just fell off, probably had a stroke and fell off backward and broke his neck and died. He had judged Israel 40 years, we're told in verse 18. His daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, had a child, and she died in childbirth. They named the son Ichabod, which means the glory is departed, because the ark was taken away. Well, the Philistines took the ark, and they brought it to Ashdod. And you know, sometimes it's easier to get a hold of something than it is to turn it loose. The Philistines had captured the ark. Now what were they going to do with it? Well, they thought they'd bring it in as a trophy to the temple of Dagon. They set it up. Early the next morning, they got up, they went in, and Dagon, this big statue of Dagon, had fallen off of its perch and was laying down face first before the ark. You know, it looked like that he was worshiping the God of Israel. That's what it looked like. So he came in, and this big statue of Dagon was falling down there, and Dagon was on his face. Well, that they took him and set him back up. Got up the next morning, came in, and he had fallen. And this time, only the stump of Dagon was left. You know, his head and his hands had all broken off. And so, you know, what did the priests of Dagon get out of this? Well, they got a superstition that you shouldn't walk on the threshold. They really connected cause and effect, didn't they? They decided maybe that was bad luck. So things were not going well. Now the people began to get sick. The hand of the Lord was heavy upon them. Verse 6, he smote them with hemorrhoids. Ashdod and the coast thereof. The men of Ashdod said, we don't think we want the ark of the God of Israel here with us anymore. So they sent it in. So they sent it down to Gath and said, you know, we think we've sort of had this thing long enough. You fellows down there, you really did a lot to conquer the Israelites, and we don't think we ought to be selfish, see, and keep the trophy. We'll send it down to you. Well, they carried it down there, and God began to smite the people of Gath, small and great. They had hemorrhoids in their secret parts. Therefore, they sent the ark of God to Ekron. And it came to pass, the ark came to Ekron. People of Ekron, see, they'd already gotten the news, and they said, we don't want it here. Don't send it to us. So they got together all the lords of the Philistines, and they said, let's send away the ark. Let's send it back to Israel. Verse 12, the men that died not were smitten with hemorrhoids, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. So they were a miserable bunch of folks. And the Ark of the Covenant was in the country of the Philistines 7 months. And the Philistines were trying to figure out how to get rid of it. They knew they were in trouble, but they didn't want to make the God of Israel madder than he already was. See, they didn't want to be disrespectful to the Ark. So they didn't quite know what to do. And they got together and they said, well, what we don't want to do is send it away empty. We need to return it with a trespass offering. You know, he could figure that out. But then they said, what do we do for a trespass offering? And verse 4, it's sort of funny what they figured out. They got to thinking about it, and they said, well, for a trespass offering, there are 5 of us kings of the Philistines, 5 cities of the Philistines. We'll send 5 golden hemorrhoids and 5 golden mice, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. So they made images of the hemorrhoids and images of the mice. And so they decided to send this back. They said, look, we don't want to harden our hearts like Egypt and Pharaoh did. We know what happened. We've heard that story. We don't want any of that. So they made a new cart, and they took two milk cows that had never been yoked up and used to pull anything, and they tied them to the cart, and they took their calves away from them and took them home. Now, you can imagine, you know, if God is not directly intervening here, what are these milk cows going to do? Number one, they've never been yoked up. So they're going to pitch and jump around, cut up. And number two, they're going to head in the direction of their calves because that's what they're going to want. So they hitch this up and they said, we don't know exactly where to send it. We'll hitch this up and we'll let the God of Israel get it there. Well, that was fine. They put all this stuff on the cart and it went up. And they took the calves home. Verse 11, they laid the ark on the cart and the little box there with all their little golden images that were the trespass offering. And the cattle, verse 12, took the straight way to the way of Beth Shemesh. They went along the highway, lowing as they went, and turned not aside from the right hand or to the left. Now, you know there was a little supernatural intervention on that. You know, here are cows going in a straight line. And you can just see them. They're just bawling for all they're worth. Their calves are back down here. But for some reason, you know, instead of turning after the calves, they're headed there on the straight and narrow. And they came down there. Came to the area of Israel. Well, the men of Beth Shemesh were reaping the wheat harvest. So this would have been, we know the timing on this. You see, this would have been in the spring. This would have been just prior to Pentecost if they were reaping the wheat harvest because the barley harvest came first and then the wheat harvest. And this was basically in the 7 weeks between Passover and Pentecost. So we're getting down close to Pentecost, which means that the ark was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months. So that means that the ark was probably captured right around the time of the fall festival, shortly after, because 6 months would bring you to Passover, from Tabernacles to Passover would be 6 months, and this is another month. There's 6 weeks, or 7 weeks rather, between Passover and Pentecost. So we're looking that the ark must have been captured right around the time of the Feast of Tabernacles, perhaps immediately after that. So these the Levites took down the ark, and the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings, and the Philistines went back home. Then we find that they sat the ark down on here, and here were these men of Beth Shemesh who showed actually less respect for the ark than the Philistines did. They wanted to come up and peep in and see what was inside. Well, God smote them with a plague, and over 50,000 died. So then the men of Beth Shemesh were all upset, and they decided who's able to stand before God. And they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, and they said, we think we'd like to send the ark down to you. So the men of Kirjath-Jearim came, fetched the ark, brought it to the house of Amminadab, and his son Eleazar was sanctified to keep the ark. And while the ark abode there, it was 20 years, and the house of the Lord lamented after, the house of Israel lamented after the Lord. Now this is the final 20 years of the 40 years of Philistine domination. Because at the end of this 20 years, Samuel spoke to the house of Israel in verse 3. So Samuel, this would have been about the time of Samson's death and the time now that Samuel, who's by this time about 40 years of age, spoke to all the house of Israel and he said, if you do return unto the Lord with all your hearts, then put away the strange God and the Ashtaroth from among you, and prepare your hearts unto the Lord, and serve Him only, and He'll deliver you out of the hand of the Philistines. So the children of Israel put away their idols. Samuel told them to gather at Mizpah, And the people confessed their sins. Verse 6, they said, we've sinned against the Eternal. Then the Philistines heard that the children of Israel were gathered together, and the Philistines went up against them. The children of Israel were afraid of the Philistines. And Samuel offered a burnt offering. Verse 10, the Philistines were drawing near. And the men of Israel, verse 11, went out from Mizpah, pursued the Philistines, and smote them until they came to Bethkar. And Samuel took a stone, set it up between Mizpah and Shin, called the name of it Ebenezer. So the Philistines were subdued, verse 13, and they came no more into the coast of Israel. And the hand of the Lord was against the Philistines all the days of Samuel. And the cities that the Philistines had taken from Israel were restored. There was peace. Verse 15, Samuel judged Israel all the days of his life. And he went from year to year in a circuit from Bethel and Gilgal and Mizpah and judged Israel in all those places. His return was to Ramah. And so this was the situation, and this went on for a number of years. It came to pass, when Samuel was old, he made his sons judges over Israel. Verse 3, his sons did not walk. All of Israel gathered themselves together, the elders, to Samuel. And they said, you're old, your sons don't walk in your ways. Make us a king to judge us like all the nations. Notice what their real motive was. They wanted to be like everybody else. That's always been the allure to the people of God. You read it through the Bible, attraction to the world. Wanting to be like everybody else, to blend in and fit in with the world. So they said, we want a king to judge us. Displeased God, displeased Samuel, and he prayed to God about it. And God said unto Samuel, hearken unto the voice of the people and all that they've said unto you, for they've not rejected you, but they've rejected me that I should not reign over. Now, you know, that's a tall statement, because the people were displeased because of the conduct of Samuel's sons. Of course, their solution wasn't going to be a solution. If you had a king, then you knew that you were going to have a father-son succession. That was not necessarily the case with the judges or the prophets. It was with the priests. Well, would you think that none of the king's sons would ever go bad? You know, the problem is Samuel's sons have been appointed judges, and they're not very honest, responsible men. So the solution is, we want a king so we can be like everybody else, because we know the king's sons will never get off the track. Well, that's sort of a foolish approach. God told Samuel, he said, they've rejected me, not you. And this is the way they've been all the way back. So Samuel told the words of the Lord to the people, verse 10. And he warned them about the manner of the king. He said he's going to institute the draft. He's going to start drafting your young men, your sons. He's going to build up a big bureaucracy, take captains of thousands and fifties, and he'll set them to ear his ground and reap his harvest and make instruments of war. He'll build up this big bureaucracy. Your daughters will be brought into service, and he'll exappropriate property. And verse 15, he's going to institute taxes. He'll take the tenth of your seed. You ever heard of fourth tithe? This is it. Income tax. The king was going to introduce a new... Now, it started off, evidently, the income tax started off with as a tithe. That was under King Saul. By the time you got to Solomon, we're told that the tax is really heavy. They were really oppressive and needed to be lightened up. So there's no telling how high they actually got up to. But what's happened ever since? You know, what did Samuel say? He said, if you get a king, you're going to complain. He's going to institute the draft. There's going to be a big bureaucracy. There's going to be heavy taxation. And you're going to be unhappy, and you're going to cry to the Lord. And, you know, people have been complaining about the government ever since. God told them what was going to happen. They refused to obey the voice of Samuel, verse 19. They said, we want to be like all the nations and have our king judge us and go out before us and fight our battles. And so he told them to all go back home. Now in chapter 9, we pick up the story of a young man by the name of Saul, who was a Benjamite. And he was an impressive looking man. He was tall and big, well proportioned. Verse 2, he was from his shoulders and upward higher than any of the people. So he was a real giant of a man, must have been approaching 7 feet tall. Certainly he was head and shoulders above everybody else, so we would say he was somewhere in the neighborhood of 7 feet tall, close to it anyway. So he was a very impressive looking man. Well, the story comes on down that his father had lost some donkeys, and Saul and one of the servants had gone looking for them, and they decided they couldn't find them, so they decided to come to Samuel and to ask him if he could, reveal to them the answer to their dilemma. Well, God told Samuel about them, that they were coming, and so when Saul got there, God inspired Samuel, and he told Saul that he was going to be chosen as king. Well, Saul's response, he said in verse 21, I'm a Benjamite, the smallest of the tribes. My family is the least of the families in Benjamin. Why are you talking like this to me? So they brought Saul in, and he was given the chief place, and was given the chief, the best cut of meat. And Saul ate with Samuel, verse 24. And so Samuel talked to him and gave him instructions. Here in chapter 10, Samuel took the vial of oil and anointed Saul to be captain over the inheritance of God. Then he gave him instructions as to what was going to happen. He was told, verse 6, the Spirit of the Lord will come upon you. And you will prophesy with them, these sons of the prophets, and you shall be turned into another man. So God began to deal with Saul. The Spirit of God came on him, and he was to be turned into another man, to be changed, to be transformed. And so he was told that Samuel gave him instructions. So the story comes on. This is exactly, of course, what happened. And they, of course, found the donkeys, just as where Samuel had told them they would. And Saul told his uncle the things that about the donkeys, but he didn't mention about that he had been anointed as king. So Samuel called the people together unto the Lord at Mizpah. And he instructed them, gave them a sermon, told them how that they had rejected God, verse 19. And then he called them to be chosen by lot as to the king. The tribe of Benjamin was taken. And then the family of Matri was taken. And then Saul, the son of Kish. Then they couldn't find Saul. And so he was hiding among the stuff. Verse 22. Saul was an individual that we would say was certainly not, initially, he was not a person who was filled with self-importance. In fact, he was sort of the opposite end, was someone that was sort of down on himself and had a little bit of what we might term an inferiority complex. He He was so overwhelmed with the idea of having to get up in front of everybody and maybe give a speech that he was hiding back there in the closet among all the stuff. So they went back and found him, brought him up there, and he was taller than anybody else. And Samuel told the people, verse 24, "You see whom the Lord has chosen. There's none like him." And all the people shouted and said, "God save the king." Samuel told the people the manner of the kingdom and wrote it in a book and laid it up before the Lord. In other words, part of Scripture. And Samuel sent all the people away, every man to his house. And Saul went home to Gibeah. And there went with him a band of men whose hearts God had touched. But there were others, sort of rebels and malcontents that despised Saul. Saul didn't seemingly quite know what to do. He just went on back home. He was the new king. Well, a little while later, Nahash the Ammonite came up and encamped against Jabesh-Gilead. And he was going to make slaves of the people there and threaten them, you see, that he'd either come in and wipe the whole place out and destroy it, or they could be his slaves. But if they were going to be his slaves, then he was going to blind them all in their right eye. He was going to deprive them of one of their eyes. And the people of Jabesh-Gilead said, "Well, look, give us a little time to think it over." And they sent messengers to Gibeah, verse 4, and told Saul. And Saul came after the herd out of the field. He was, you know, just sort of gone back to the farm. And they told him what had happened. And verse 6, "The Spirit of God came upon him when he heard these tidings. His anger was kindled greatly. And he took a yoke of oxen, hewed them in pieces, sent them throughout the coast of Israel, and said, 'Whosoever comes not forth after Saul and after Samuel, I'm going to do to you what I did to these oxen.'" Well, that sort of got people's attention, you know. The fear of the Lord fell on the people. They came out with one consent. You know, it's sort of like the story of the mule. First, you got to get his attention. Well, Saul took a bold step here, and there was a large contingent, about 350,000 men, and they came up to Jabesh-Gilead and slew the Ammonites. And so then they went back to Gilgal to renew the kingdom. And the people went to Gilgal, verse 15, made Saul king before the Lord in Gilgal. And so this was a renewal of the kingship. And Samuel said to all Israel, now as he's speaking to them here in Gilgal, this is of course where initially, you know, that's where the ark was first set up when Joshua crossed the river, the Jordan. That was the original encampment. It was there in Gilgal. So Samuel reminded them, he said, "I've done what you ask. I've made a king. And your king walks before you, and I'm old and gray-headed, and my sons are with you. And I've walked before you from my childhood unto this day." And he said, "I'm here. Now, if any of you have any complaints against me, I want to know. Whose ox have I taken? Whose ass have I taken? Who have I defrauded? Who have I oppressed? Who have I taken bribes from? You tell me." And they all acknowledge, "No, you've never defrauded us. You've never oppressed us. You've never..."